Listening to Mark Bingham here in the background, and great, great album he came out with a while back, and we're going to be listening to some more, but mainly we're going to be talking to him. But here's a little something from an album he just produced called, well, it's by Michaud's Melody Makers, and it's a live album, and it's really, really good. It's called Cajuns from Saturn, and yeah, here we go. So that, of course, was a new track by our friend Louis Michaud, from the brand new record that they just came out with, Cajuns from Saturn, live, just recorded this last December, I believe, and we're lucky enough to have producer, legendary producer, musician, Mark Bingham with us right now, who has done so much work, as we discussed earlier, on so many of my favorite recordings. And Mark, honored to have you on Finn's Revolution on WUSB.
Yes, nice to be here.
That's great. And Mark, of course, is a legendary not only producer, but studio owner and a whole bunch of things, and has just facilitated so many recordings, working with people. Well, we'll get to that. Mark. So we started off that set there with My Enemy from your album, Psalms of Vengeance. You want to talk a little about Psalms of Vengeance?
I was like in the 90s, I started working on these songs, and it took a long time because I was doing other things, and I didn't really have, there's no one clamoring for any Mark Bingham records. So I just put some things together when I had time. And then I went through a period where I didn't have a place to live, and I didn't have a studio or anything from like the mid 99 to about 2001. And then I got another situation set up, and I started working on it again. And so I pretty much got it done by about 2004, and then was trying to figure out what to do with it. And then Katrina came along, and everything else took precedent, and it took another like 4 years for it to come out. So really, I think of that record as something that was like from the 90s, even though it came out 10 years later.
But also something that was born and bred in New Orleans, and which is where you are and where you were.
Well, I'm out in the swamp now. I'm not in New Orleans anymore.
But right.
I was in New Orleans. I've been in Louisiana since 1982.
Yeah, So that development of that just all happened in between your projects, I'm guessing, and in between the downtime of Katrina. Yeah.
If somebody, I had some songs, if I was having musicians, I would, for one thing, and we had some downtime, it would happen. I would like, oh, let's track this, track that. I'd trade people for studio time for them playing, however I could get it done. And then I slowly pieced it together. And I remember, now it's like a lot of the stuff, you piece it together, and then once it's done, you kind of learn it and it's a song. But a lot of those things weren't songs even before they just started out. I think my favorite one on there is, I don't know what it's called. It's either called Harlot's Ghost or Mailer. And I love that piece. It's like the strangest piece. And I remember when I made that riff in sitting in my living room in like the 80s, and it just took that long for it to turn into a piece. And I loved the Barry sax and the bass sax. You know, it had some really interesting textures to it. So that one I loved.
Yeah, and that's and as a producer, as a guy working generally on other people's music for a living and for an art, you certainly managed to pull out some gorgeous stuff, really cool stuff for your own project, it's a beautiful record.
The star of that record to me is Jaleesa Anderson.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I don't know if you're familiar with her stuff.
I'm familiar with her stuff from your stuff.
Well, she was, I swear she was like the first singer in Massive Attack, and she's
right.
Singing all background vocals on the first Bjork record.
Right.
And her mama was Vicki Anderson, who was with James Brown.
I think you're right.
Yeah, so she's like, and she's lived in England for a really long time, but she was back in New Orleans during that time, and I helped her on a thing, and she liked what I was doing and came in, and I think, she did some remarkable singing on that, and which propped me up because, you know, I'm not exactly Caruso.
Well, you do project the song, that's for sure.
Well, that, you know, yeah, that one, that man in Marseille, the thing she did on that was really something. I'm remembering all this now because I haven't heard that record in ages. Sometimes I'll play some of those tunes and I'll have to go back and go, okay, I know how they go, but I just have to refresh.
I'm not asking you to play them now, so we're all right. You don't have to take a guitar out.
I got one here.
So
a bass solo. I just found these old, I played on the same bill with Captain Beefheart in 1970, and we recorded it from the back of the hall on a little on the analog tape recorder. And then I had these tapes forever, and I just was listening to Mark Boston's bass solos from that gig. And I was sending the people, and I sent them to Shane Terrio, who's like, loves Beefheart, and he's the music director for Hall & Oates. That's how weird the world is, right? Everybody's getting these old Beefheart tapes.
That's also super cool. You came in at a certain time. Yeah. All the people you worked with, it's absolutely amazing, especially when you first were coming up and you were a kid really. You came into, how did it all happen that you wound up where you wound up, like with Elektra and all that stuff? It was like kind of a freak thing, don't you think?
Well, remember that in those days, I think, you know, they, maybe 400 records a year were released, and now 400 records a day are released. And so there wasn't this huge, you know, the record labels were the arbiters of taste, and you figured if something was on Columbia Records or Atlantic, it was going to be worth listening to. And music people still ran the music world. And so, you know, it wasn't like in those days, like they have these people running record labels, they didn't know. And they said, ah, this kid, that's kind of cool. Maybe we can sell some, you know. I mean, it was almost on that level. And so I just was in a band. And I was living in Mount Kisco, across the bay there from where you are, you know. And my high school band started playing a lot, and we started writing, and I started making tapes, and then I won some band battles. And then the next thing I knew, the people were taking me to Elektra, who signed me up. It was like, but they signed me up because I was making very weird, constructed electronic-y pieces with singing on top of them. So as soon as they signed me up, they wanted me to write like John Phillips. So I was confused right away. The music business baffled me from the get-go. But you know, when you're like 17 and you get $500 in the mail, and you know, and I was like 17. I was an athlete. I wasn't a hip kid. I didn't know shit. But you know, we won the band battle. Howard Cosell, Cousin Brucey, and Bill Harvey from Elektra were the judges. And so, you know, Cosell loved it. Cosell liked what I did. And Bill Harvey was like, really? You know? So they brought me the publishing people, and they said, well, yeah, songs. Yeah, we always need songs. But I was a complete flop as a songwriter. I mean, I still don't think I know how to write a song, but you know, I make things, but I don't know, you know, I don't know what they are. And so, you know, that it started, and because I had made all these weird, I had ganged five tape recorders together, they decided I should be an apprentice producer. So they started letting me hang around and see what the big guys did. And that was where I really learned, you know.
Yeah, how was that? How was that experience meeting all those? Because you were exposed to a lot of guys early on that really were experienced in doing some cutting edge stuff. We want to talk about that a little bit.
Essentially, they don't remember you. They don't talk to you. They don't remember you. You get the coffee. You move the microphone. You keep the track sheet. You put the flag. You used to have to put flags in the reel-to-reel tapes with numbers on them to know where the takes were, because there was no auto locators. Even it was like this is the old shit. And that's, it was like four tracks, you know.
Right.
I had to go out and learn how to do recording and record demos and things. But the Star people, I mean, it's always the case. Like, even like years later, I worked with Van Dyke Parks. And
one of my favorites.
Every time I see Van Dyke or get in touch with him, he never remembers. He's like, oh, Mark, I've done so many sessions, you know. And I'm like, oh. And this is like one of the most important things in my life, and you don't remember. You know? So that's sort of how I feel. You know, it's like you're just a fly in the wall. Like Peter Stampfl, I continue to work with, who's 81 now, on the Holy Moly Rounders session, he didn't even remember that I was there. I mean, but everyone was on multiple drugs except for me and Sam Shepard. And Sam drank. And I was just like, had to be sober because I had to drive here and do this and do that and do this. But Peter didn't remember. But last fall, we played Radio City Music Hall when they did the revision of Easy Rider with the original music played live.
Right.
By whoever was left alive. And I was the only person left from the Holy Motor Rounders session. And Peter still didn't remember that I was there. He was pretty funny. I pointed out to Elektra that they had ripped off the song from Ray Price, because I was already a country music fan then.
Uh-huh.
And it was the Ray Price song, well, if you tell me that's a carol, now you're gone, you got me crying. There's no denying, you done me wrong. If you want to be a bird, why don't you try a little flying? You know, I mean, hello, same song. Anyway, but nobody cared, and Ray Price didn't say anything, so that song has gone all these years. And there it is. But so, you know, hanging around, I remember Jim Morrison as a really nice guy, but he wouldn't, I mean, he's dead, so he wouldn't remember me at all. I remember, I mean, but most of it was just like the A&R people, the Paul Rothschild, Bruce Botnick. I think, you know, I was tolerated. Mm. I was an 18-year-old kid in the way, or tried to stay out of the way, and lucky to be there. So, you know. And I lived in Laurel Canyon. Oh, my God. Then that was a whole nother story, you know. But nobody remembers this shit. Well, I was looking at, I saw Psalms of Vengeance the other day, and I was looking at the credits, and I realized that I had not thought about any of those assistant engineers in years.
Right.
And then I remembered who they were and what they were doing at Piety Street. But I hadn't thought about it. So I don't know.
Well, it all becomes, you know, it's your... you're doing the work as you're doing it. So it's like, yeah, you're not keeping a diary. You're doing the work as you're doing it. So yeah, but your whole career bouncing around with all those people is stunningly amazing. And Stampfl, I mean, everyone has their different, I mean, you've worked with huge people, but Stampfl is somebody I wish I was a fly on the wall for some of those sessions, but yeah.
We just, the new thing that we did, which is coming out in November 27.
Right.
We did one song per year for the 20th century. It took us 18 years. But Peter's also the world's greatest procrastinator. And, you know, there's all the, you know, we're in a world now where there's all these catchphrases and mindfulness and living in the moment and all. Well, Peter's living in the moment. He's so far in the moment that all the moments that were half done remain half done forever until he remembers them and goes into that moment again. So Peter's like, really, I've never met anyone like him. And we've been, you know, I've been playing with him off and on since the 70s after, of course, he didn't remember that I was even there initially. He didn't remember that I drove him home every night. He didn't, nothing. I mean, he did. But Peter, yeah. Oh, so we did 100 songs, and the Melody Makers are on it. The Lost Boy Ramblers are on it. A bunch of people. It's just Jonathan Frelick from the New Orleans Klezmer All Stars is like helped me a lot on the record. He played in about 60. I played in about 90 of them. It's quite, you know, Peter doing Goodbye Yellow Brick Road. Peter, the first song is I Love You Truly, 1901, and the last song is Yellow by Coldplay.
Well, there you go. It certainly ranges the century.
Plus. Yeah, so anyway, we actually did this. So in the 82, people will be 82 when it comes out.
Oh, man, that is so cool. So how many tracks did you edit it down to?
No, it's 100.
There's 100 tracks that you're releasing?
It's 5 CDs. It's going to be 5 CDs.
Mark, oh, my God. 100 tracks.
Yeah, it's 100 tracks. I'm serious. It's 100 songs.
I believe you. But it's incredible.
Peter Stanford, 20th Century. And I thought that was done by, 2008. But then we ran into it. Peter just didn't really know much about the last 20 years, and he got involved in all these other projects. And then we kept trying to get him to, what about this? But we finally got.
So was there a lot of mixing done on that project? Was there overdubs and all these things happening, or was it like a live recording?
It's like, let's imagine that I spent 10 hours a song.
Oh my God.
Probably like any record that you do where you have to mix, you have to do that. So that's called 1,000 hours, right?
Oh my God.
But then on the other hand, the Doors took it almost 1,000 hours to make the Soft Parade, which they should never even have released. So, it's all relative.
It's all about the quality. I got you.
That's why I remember that song. I heard that song a lot when I was at LA. But the song used to go, come on, hit me, babe. And then Morrison was getting a bad rep, so they made him change it to Touch Me. This is the kind of dumb shit that I saw in the music business. What? Oh, no, he's like, we can't let the Lizard King. The Lizard King is getting love handles and getting out. We don't want him hitting any women.
So Stample was well-behaved in his songs and didn't offend too many people?
We made a song, or I will play with Peter on something that probably will never come out. It's about, let's do it in the graveyard. It's pretty sick. So, he's like, he's hiking up somebody's skirt up against a tombstone, he's still in, he's still in his strange world. And, but no, he's fine. Peter comes in and he does his stuff. And then, we were in a band together once and I quit when he shattered a bourbon glass in my face, beating on it with a drumstick like a cowbell. I was like, glass in the eyes is not good.
Not good. That's right. All right. So you have, let's get into some other bands. I have to tell you that the Flat Duo Jets album that you produced, recorded, I don't know how much production was really involved. Was there a lot of production involved in the Flat Duo Jets record?
Well, it depends. What is production?
Right.
What is anyone? Could be any number of things. And for that, the production is, I played with a bunch of gigs with them. I figured out what they sounded like. And Dexter would introduce me as Bill Haley, middle-aged bald dude. That was a long time ago and I was already old in the music business,
Yeah.
So.
A beautiful record, Dexter, though, that stands up unbelievably well through any period of music, don't you think?
Did you get the reissue, the box set thing that came out where I put out all the outtakes and there was some other stuff? So essentially it's like this. So we had, was going to Georgia. If you read the liner notes of that thing, this story kind of. We went to this place to record his big theater. And I thought it'd be great to record them in a big space. And I set up a control room, but we were going straight to tape like Sam Phillips. It wasn't no overdubs. So I had a tape machine set up for tape echo. I had a digital console and then I had a bunch of really good microphone preamps and microphones. So it wasn't, production. Yeah. It was like, how do you envision this? Now I know what the band sounded like and the band, a lot of people then, other producers and engineers were like, dude, how could you put your name on that shit? you know? See, and I was like, well, that's what the band sounds like.
Right.
Well, you should have made them sound better. And I was like, no, that's not how it works.
Right.
You know, so it was always a philosophical thing. What does a producer do? If you're a shill, or a lot of friends of mine were like pimps for the record labels, and there were, you know, X number of producer agents, and they all worked for the labels. And anyway, you know, that whole thing in the 80s and 90s of, and I was never in that club because I just wasn't in that. I wasn't ready to just shine stuff up to be, you know, perfect for that world. And I couldn't do it, but he, and it turned out the guy had not paid his bills. I guess he was doing drugs. He was this and that. He had taken an axe to a Georgia a gas company truck that tried to turn his gas off. He had axed the guy's, put an axe through the hood of his car, of truck. So all over the move. So up back in Athens, where can we work? Jim Hawkins, this guy used to be a sound guy for the Allman Brothers, was living there. We got his place, and it was like nasty. He hadn't been in there for months, but the band loved it. You know, there were like moldy bottles of Heineken, you know, that from 2 years ago. It was nasty. And so, and I set up around the corner. I couldn't see the band, but we set up the same rig. So there's two distinct sounds. There's the huge sound, like on that song, Baby.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the smaller sound, like Wild Wild Lover was in the small room. So you, if you really want to analyze production, you can see, yeah. And so much of, you know, I grew up, bands were in big rooms, and they'd play together out on the floor in a big room, and you'd record it. And that's what I saw people doing, and I saw Judy Collins records that way, and what any, you know, all the stuff in L.A. It was like, and then it started going in the 70s. They started putting people into boxes and then adding reverb and all that crap.
Right.
But, you know, so the Flat Bureau Jets was back to that old school, bunch of people in a room playing music, and you get it on there, and there it is.
Well, that's what strikes me about your production, and no matter who you've produced, actually, is that you tend to really play to how the band works. And if the band plays best live in a room, that's what you've been doing, and you really are the servant of the music, and you bring out the best in it.
Well, that's what you try to do. But the thing is, you got to remember, I spent so much time by the mid '90s through 2010. I did a lot of engineering. I wasn't an engineer until the late '80s, say. And then I learned how to do that just by because I had learned really at Elektra to do two track and record, but then mostly I was playing and arranging and producing, but I learned how to be an engineer. So I spent a lot of time being an engineer, working with producers that really were, some were great and some didn't have a clue. And some producers think they're supposed to take over everything and stick their nose in everything. And some producers are just are casters, like Hal Wilner, he would cast things and then, you know, he'd have things to say, but it wasn't like he was in the middle of it. The musicians did what musicians did.
Right, and that's actually the next direction we were going. Your work with the great Hal Wilner, presence missed in the music business, certainly. You did tons of work with him on some of my favorite albums, including the Thelonious Monk tribute, of course, the first Lost in the Stars, all that. And how was it working with Hal Wilner, and you were just starting to discuss his approach to pretty much just letting musicians do what they do, but he also had a bit of a, he was also very hands-on to a certain degree, right?
Well, it depends. Like today, I was just working on this sort of Hal memorial piece.
Really?
And I just finished it, and it's an odd record. It's Gregory Corso, Marianne Faithfull, and Hal, and they're talking, and it's kind of outtakes and leftover stuff from a Gregory Corso record from 2000, obviously before he died.
Hmm.
And so I finished the thing, and everyone loved it, and then I was listening to the end, and I said, oh, the end isn't right. I got to change it. And so I told the guy, the record guy, and then he was like, well, maybe you can do that. I was like, uh-oh, I opened a can of worms. And so I called Stephen Bernstein, and I said, Stephen, what do you want to, what can I do in the end here to make this work? And he was like, oh, and Stephen goes, well, Hal would put like a sample of Albert Eiler over the whole thing, you know. And I'd be like, yeah, too, but we, you know. So, you know, Hal, I think the last record I really worked a whole lot on with Hal was this Marian Faithful record, and he put a ton of samples in there, but then he would just go off and, you know, Skype with his son and have fun and leave me to place all the samples and do this and then come back. Well, can you move this one over here for you? Okay, good. All right, and then gone again for 2 hours. So, you know, and that was kind of like I met him when my ex-wife worked on Saturday Night Live, and that's sure. when I met Hal at Saturday Night Live. And I was trying to do a Bernard Herrmann tribute. And I had, like, the Lounge Lizards, the Ray Beats, the Sadie, Schofield and Swallow, Elliot Sharp. That's a, you know, and then I went to labels and I'd say, oh, I got it. And they'd say, we wouldn't put out any of those people. Why would we want all of them on one record?
Oh my God.
You know, and seriously. And so I got completely nowhere. Hal's dad, it was able to get him enough dough to get concession, get it right. And then Hal, then that's on the puzzle. We figured out the puzzle, which was the record labels would go for it if there's somebody on there that people know.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, I believe that Debbie Harry got on the first thing doing some wordless stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, and there was somebody on Amram was on that record, which is great. And I was in Amram's band for a while in 1972.
Right.
Go figure.
I've read that.
And that's how could you read that? Was I didn't know anyone even knew that.
Yeah, it's out there.
I remember the parts that I sang, you know, on the song. So, I was trying to do that, and then Hal got the Rhoda thing up, and then we were just kind of like always hanging out and talking about this, talking about that, doing this music. He was coming down. He'd come down to visit when I moved to New Orleans. He came down to visit for Jazz Fest the year that I was there. And then the Monk thing came along, and he actually said, oh, do a track. And I was like, okay. So I learned Brilliant Corners, but
yeah.
I could not figure out the bridge. So I went to Schofield, and I was like, dude, how do you got it to, you know. So Schofield showed me the picture. Otherwise, it never would have happened, because I would have still be trying to figure out that bridge.
And, well, he's a guy to go to. He's a guy to go to.
And Stephen Bernstein says, that's how music works. I shouldn't feel like, you know, I'm a schmuck because I couldn't figure it out. And I got John and Swallow and Joey Barron, and mm-hmm. we played this, and I had an idea for the arrangement, which was like, I've been thinking about Messiaen, and, you know, the composer, and how he would like to layer quarter time against half time against regular time against double time,
mm-hmm.
and just moved a few notes to make it work. And that was one of his, you know, composition techniques. And I thought, well, let's do the Messiaen on the Monk and start in quarter time and then double it and then double it. And, you know, and that's what he did. Simple as that. And then everyone dug it. So, and then suddenly, yeah, Hal could put me on other stuff because that got enough attention to be like, okay, this stuff.
You
this guy has a wing.
This just all your work with Wilner in general has been just great, and he's certainly a production hero of mine. Just listening to him, and can you talk a little about working with Ginsberg on The Lion for Real, and anything else you might want to speak about with him?
Oh yeah, well, I mean, Allen Ginsberg was just an amazing man, and just always inspired me. And the first night that, you know, I went, I had been around him. And again, this is that whole thing of when you're a young person that's docking around scenes. I remember maybe it was 71, New Year's Eve, 71, 72. I went to the church on, I think it was St. Mark's Church, 9th Avenue and 1st Avenue and 9th Street, is that it? 2nd Avenue and 9th Street, there's a church. Anyway, they had a New Year's Eve show. Ultraviolet, Holy Modal Rounders and Allen Ginsberg.
And that was a very early version of that show. That was great. I wasn't there, but I've heard it. Yeah, yeah.
There wasn't but 50 people there, you know, but,
right.
you know, Lou Reed and the Velvets, all that kind of crowd, and Ultraviolet, all those people were all there. You know, Holly Woodlawn and that whole thing. So I didn't know any of this stuff. I don't know who these people were. You know, I was just like, still like, I had gone been at Elektra, but I was still like this kid. I don't know what's going on. So I saw Alan there, and I remember, and Alan would always try to pick you up, you know, which was,
right.
which was doing, I think, one of the last.
You were the right. You were the right. You were the right age, you know. So.
Yeah, I don't care about the Grim Reaper. I'm going to get into his pants, you know. And so then, you know, we met Alan. Me and Hal and Alan went out and talked about it, what we were going to do, and I picked the poems. And then, as the whole band, we all got together and. And went over what we were going to do and how we were going to do it. And then we went in the studio, and Alan was great. He just hung in there and did it every night. And we spent a lot of time. We went to Woodstock and worked. And I got to spend a lot of time around him. And we played some gigs. It was really fun. And just an altogether inspiring human being, you know.
Yeah, and that combination of records that came out right then, the Mark Ribot record, the Burroughs record, and the Lion for Real, was just like an amazing combo of records that came out. It was so inspiring, you know.
Yeah, now that I think the Lion for Real is still, you can listen to it, and you know, you know, the rim shot here would be, it's a poetry record, and you can listen to it.
But, right.
you know, I've made a bunch. Poetry records now, so I mean, in this new one I'm making, you know. So this new one is all Gregory Corso, and a lot of it with Marianne Faithfull speaking the poems because Gregory was kind of like on his last legs, you know.
Yeah,
and Marianne was co-producer with Hal, so that was curious.
Yeah, and you were just discussing earlier your beautiful work with Marianne with Horses and High Heels we were just talking about. But, I mean, it's your work with all these people has just been very intuitive, very gracious, very beautiful, and you're really thinking as you either play or arrange and produce. So it's just great.
Well, good. I'm glad. Glad somebody in the world likes it.
Well, now, speaking of things we like, we're going to take a quick break here. And then we're going to move on to the extremely current day. And of course, I could talk to you for hours and hours about your amazing career. But we're going to move to the extreme current day after this break. What would you like to hear out of the various tracks? I mean, it can be from the current Michaud's Melody Makers to your earliest track. What would you like to hear right now that we can play?
The earliest track?
Anything you want.
What have you got there? Do you have Stay Awake then?
Of course.
Right?
Yeah, we have Stay Awake.
Play the James Taylor track from Stay Awake.
You got it. Stay Awake is one of my favorite records. All the reimaginings of Disney songs and with Hal essentially at the helm and Mark right there as well. And it's a beautiful thing. And I think this track is beautiful. So we'll be right back.
Yeah.
We'll be right back with Mark Bingham right here on Finn's Revolution on WUSB, Stony Brook.
The second star to the right. it's Neverland you need. Its light will lead you there. Oh, twinkle, twinkle, little star, so I'll know where you are, gleaming in the sky.
We just heard James Taylor right there from the Stay Awake album, tribute to Disney songs, which had a great effect on my life when I was a kid. And the reworkings of it that came out quite a number of years ago, I think it was in the 89 or something like that, maybe.
88.
Oh, 88. There's Mark right there. And we're talking to Mark Bingham, who had a big hand in that. Mark, let's talk a little about the beauty of that particular tune and the project in general.
Well, the project took a long time. I spent like a long, long time working on that with Hal and going to Los Angeles and going here and going there. And the session in Los Angeles where we did Ringo Starr, Harry Nilsson, and Ema Sumac in one day with 50-piece orchestra. That was a day to remember. And then, you know, when we find the James Taylor track, I remember it was in the winter, because I think James had he drove from Boston, and he's the kind of guy that, even though he's James Taylor, he was tired and he pulled into a rest area and went to sleep in his car, you know, to take a nap. That's why I love the guy. And we went to his house to rehearse. His mother called him J-Mo and made us sandwiches. You know, it was like, you know, you say, okay, great. This is perfect, you know. And why was his mother there? That's a good question. I don't know. Maybe she lived. I don't know. But the guy's like a brilliant guitar player.
Right.
And I had sort of a snotty attitude about the records he was making. So did Hal, kind of. We were like, we got to make something that's different, because he does all that vanilla stuff and this gets into music and arranging, whereas they would make everything be perfect.
Right.
You know, they had the best players and they all, there was the shortest distance between two chord changes, not music at all. And James would sing perfect and it was all perfect.
Right.
And we were like, oh, let's take this standard tune and then make really weird substitutes chords to it, so it sounds really more Bill Evans-y out there than. So okay, so we get in there to rehearse, and then I put that music down, and the piano player with James, who was his music director, his eyebrows came up about every two bars, looking at me like, "Are you fucking nuts?" Yeah. So then he was like, he just wasn't in. He was like, "What?" You know. You know, and Schofield came in and was like, okay, let's do this instead. And he helped smooth it out. So I still got my stuff, and the other guy wasn't appalled. James, meanwhile, didn't really say much anything about it. He was just going to sing. And then, you know, we did the session. It was great. I was sitting there playing, thinking, holy shit, it's James Taylor in the headphones. You know, you don't have those kind of experiences all that time. Because, you know, when I was a kid, James Taylor was like something. I thought the early stuff was really interesting. And I think he's always just, his guitar playing just killed me how great it was. And then I think Branford came in. And I still have never met Branford Marsalis. And I'm on the same record with him from 30 years ago. And I know I met all his other brothers, and I knew his dad and his mom, you know, but never met Branford. And we were both mutual friends with Bruce Hampton. So this was, I never could somehow get this circle to come together. You know?
So James comes in and he does his thing, and were you guys floored by his version, or were you just like, this is a perfect mix of the music plus the version, or what?
I thought he was having trouble with it, you know, and he finally got something that we all thought was okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, Maggie and Terry and Suzy came in, and we did this humming and these background things,
uh-huh.
and he did the middle part, and it was a great night. It was the studio on 13th Street. Was it 12th or 13th? It was near those. It used to have the cool theaters for $1.
The downtown. Yeah.
Where it was. You know, it was like sometimes, you know, there's a thing with, you talk about producing records, and like working with Mac Rebinac, what I got from him and what I saw really from really work being in the LA in the late 60s was, okay, you have a song. Is the song right? Okay. Now, second start of the right, there it is. Great song.
Yes.
Messed it up too bad. And then you go, okay, there's an intro, there's verses, there's choruses, there's bridge, is there any instrumental tag? Why is the arrangement straight? Is it in tune? Is it in time? Does it end properly? You do all that and it's done. It's not like making an Edward Sharp record where you sit there for 6 months going over this thing. You know, I mean, which that's a fairly reasonable thing. Now, I love that band, but, you know, I just watched them work on shit for 6 months when I was like, it's fine. Not getting any better. But, you know, that's like Alex, he was the genius, so he has to do that. But he gets to do that, and that's good. But, so anyway, so I always think it's the other way around. You, when the music is performed as it should be, it's done. And very seldom do you get more audience, get more connection with other human beings, or sell anything more by spending days and days and weeks perfecting something that you don't really know what you're perfecting. You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's not like writing a book where you have to write it 8 times until you get it.
Right, and it's the crew you're working with at that moment, and that's why they call it a record, right? It's a record, you know.
And Harold Batiste is the same way. Harold Batiste was in New Orleans, great producer, and he was the same way. He was like, "Yeah, it's good, it's done, let's do it, move on." Boom.
Right.
So I got to see a lot of it, you know, and you know, Hal would do that, and then Hal was into mixing forever. Hal would mix, and it was like, oh, yeah, and it was good, though, but he always had good ideas. But he wasn't like a circular mixer. Let's see, I can't speak ill of the dead, like trying to mix with Glenn Branca was like, he just go round, round, and around, and you're like, dude, everything can't be louder.
Did you, as a producer, do you have that switch under the board that you know, tells people that's the more me switch, the louder switch?
Well, you try to do it. Nobody in the band gets to tell you to turn themselves up.
Right.
But it's hard, you know, because people hear things like, people don't know what it's like in a studio. You know, like you'll hit it. You'll mute something for a while, or you put a solo button on, and somebody will jump up off the couch freaking out because they don't know that's normal. And you know, so you got to get used to it. You know, it's a very cool medium, going back to 50 years ago, going back to Marshall McLuhan. You know, it's not exciting. You don't want to be all excited in the studio. It's, you know, methodical, you know, plan it out and do what you do. And
that's what you seem to do consistently. So let's bring us up to date. You've been working with Luis Michaud and his band. And tell us a little about how that has been. You're down in New Orleans. You're in the heart of it all. They just came out with a great, great record, great live record, which actually... it's kind of trance-inducing to me because of the live mix on the whole thing. but I don't know how you feel about it, but it's gorgeous. And go ahead.
No, I mean, okay. That record, I just wanted to play the guitar, you know, and I hooked up a good mic setup and good some mic preamps, and my friend Chris Block came and recorded it. Because everybody in that band is a record producer, and
right.
the bass and the drummer are both really good engineers too. So
right.
it's kind of like, you know, anybody could have done it, and I was like, okay, I'm going to play guitar on this, and then I'm not going to sit there and listen. But it turned out we all end up listening to two nights of things. We ended up using everything from the second night anyway. But, you know, it sounded great, and it just evolved. And somebody started trying to mix it, and then I was like, nah. Somebody else came and did a bunch of stuff on top of their mix, and then that was weird, and I was like, okay, I'll just do it. So then I came in and mixed it, and then that was it. So it was really by happenstance, you know, because I kept saying, I want to be the guitar player. I don't want to know how the sausage is made, you know?
Right.
but it wasn't a painful experience mixing everything. It was fine. Then I mixed it once. Louis heard it. Everybody heard it. I got some notes from people. Did it again, got it pointed on, and eventually there it was. It was good. And, you know, it all went by so fast. I was really glad Louis, I mean, I had this name, Cosmic Cajuns from Saturn, because I thought of it as like Attack of the 50-Foot Woman or something.
Oh, so this is your idea. So this is your idea, Mark, right? The title?
Yeah, I have a package in there. Yeah, that's a good idea. So I was glad that went there. I usually don't get any say on the packaging, and so I really think this could have been produced by everyone. It could have been produced by me and Louis. It could have been produced by me and Louis and Chris Block. So what did I do? Well, I played guitar. I had four corrections in my guitar playing that I was able to. And there was one note, the very first note in the record was weird because on the bass, because he was going from pads to the bass. And he missed coming in, so I pulled the note from somewhere else. So otherwise, it's 100% live with five Pro Tools fixes, and some of those were just noises and shit that happened in the turn, you know, between, you know. So, but it was, it's great. I think it sounds great. People seem to like it, so that's, there you are.
I love it, and I find it a little different from, Ramblers live recordings that I've heard and that are bootlegged and stuff is out there, but it's different because it's even there's a certain drone that's just like a drone and a groove that happens in combination, and I don't know how much quote unquote mixing was involved with that, but the level of it is just incredible. It's like a Cajun trance, Mark. I'm telling you.
I mean, the thing is, we're doing this old music, and the old music was very trancy.
Yeah.
And then by the 50s, it changed to what people think of as modern Cajun music. And then by the 70s, with, you know, Beausoleil and his bands that were really, really good players and expanded it a little bit. But the old stuff was very raw and very punk, you know?
Yeah.
And Uncle Gaspar and that world.
Right, right, right.
And so Louis like mines that territory. And then we play it different all the time. So we really, it's just like kind of what these four people do. Because the Lost Valley Ramblers play, it doesn't sound like this.
Right.
And even though those three, you know, sound a certain way. But I think Brian Weber doing the pads is pretty amazing. And both of those guys doing pads are good. And this record is very different. The first record we made was very much like song by song in the studio, and this one is what we've been doing live for a year, and you know.
And it's also nice that you guys caught it and recorded it. I don't know how much you guys had been you know, a lot of times people record a lot but they don't necessarily use it for something, but you guys caught it what in December just of last year, and enabling you to put it out this year despite all virus concerns and all those things. So it was great that you caught it when you caught it.
Yeah, well, we don't record shows all the time. I mean, we play so many shows that, you know, it's kind of like to get there, and we set up our own PA, and we, you know, and all that. So it's, you know, the idea of recording, it takes a little effort, and all of us as being doing what we do outside of the band, too, the idea of doing a cheesy, lousy recording is not really appealing. So we have to do it properly.
Yeah.
You know, we did it. This was done properly.
Yeah, it's such an atmospheric recording. It's just like you feel like you are immersed in the situation. You feel like you're right, maybe 10 feet from the stage while this is being, you know what I mean?
Yeah, and Louis, you know, there's a lot of noisy stuff going on with us.
That's great.
Louis playing a tape recorder, and he's got this distortion thing going. And
right.
So it's different. It's a different edge than most of the stuff you hear on any level. I mean, thing now, there's so much music that's in certain pockets. And, you know, you go to listen to all the music that's coming out of Nigeria or Cameroon or Congo or so, and there's different vibe going on there, and it's nothing like any of the stuff from America.
Right.
And you know, so you start thinking about music in a global level, and you know, we're just, you know, more, you know, in some kind of netherworld. We're not, who knows where how we started doing this, but we did. And we didn't do it to be different or innovative, which is like I pointed out to people, because you know, this band is sort of like the Cajun and Roman. And I don't know where the cosmic stuff probably comes from, my, you know, so.
Yeah, well, Louis and I have discussed this before, you know. I always, when I hear a record like this, I always think of the him talking to me about listening to the Velvet Underground and all those things. And you hear those drones, and it's all there, you know.
Right. Oh, think of that. One of the records I got to work on in L.A., totally uncredited, and just as a fly on the wall, was the Nico Marble Index that John Cale made all the tracks for.
Really? You worked on that?
Well, I was there. Fraser Mohawk was my producer, and I lived in his house.
Yeah. Fraser Mohawk, right.
You know, and Nico was the across the street neighbor.
That is one of my favorite records of all time. So what'd you wind up doing on that record? Did you?
No one is dead.
You have to be sampled for this, just by yourself.
I could do Lawns of God.
Oh, by God. Wow, that is something else. Now I'm going to have to put this on after this interview is over. So we're going to have to work on that. So we're just about out of time here, Mark. And we've been talking to Mark Bingham right here on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook. And we're talking a wide range of stuff, including his work on the latest Michaud's Melody Makers record, which is phenomenal. And thank God Mark moved down to New Orleans when he did, way back when. And maybe we can have another interview with Mark talking about the Piety days and all of that, because some amazing work was done at studios that Mark has run, not just Piety, but others as well. And Mark, I want to thank you for joining us on Finn's Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook. And I'd like to know what you'd like to hear, maybe from the new Michaud album or anything else you'd like to go out with.
We have the Son of Rogues Gallery, too.
Sure, we got that.
Can you play filthy songs?
I think so. Are all the lyrics clean on that one?
I don't think so.
I don't think so.
Okay, I was going to say play the Big Frida and Katie Red track. But I won't do that. Okay, play Jumon du Michaud.
Oh, that's beautiful. I love it. And
that one instead.
And I know
remember
it.
That one.
I know it. That's gorgeous. That's a closer, right?
What is it? I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's no, the close. No, it's not
there's
the close.
That's the third song on the record.
Oh, okay, third song in. Okay. But a beautiful track. And Mark Bingham, whose career has been amazing and immense, and we shall be speaking to Mark hopefully again in the future when he knocks out some new releases post-COVID and maybe pre-post-COVID. We'll see what happens, if there is such a thing as post-COVID. By the way, Mark, just very briefly, how are you faring down there in New Orleans with the whole situation?
Well, New Orleans is sort of went up, went down, went up. I mean, there's not much you can do when people won't wear masks and won't stop hanging around with each other and go to bars. And, it's like there's nothing you can do about it. And I've been basically quarantined here out in the country in the swamp. I'm 20 miles from Louis. I'm in Henderson, Louisiana.
Okay.
And I've been in my studio and I mixed the Stephen Bernstein record. I've been mixing a bunch of stuff. I made this one side of this record that's coming out that's Gregory Corso on one side and has a Ginsberg poem on the other. And so I've just been doing my business, you know. And it's weird because I don't go anywhere. I go to the back of Walmart and they bring food and put it in my car. I haven't been to a restaurant. I won't even go in a store or anything around here. I mean, and so right now this whole area is lit up red. And you could see it coming because the people were just going, and I'd be wearing a mask 4 months ago, early in March.
Yeah, right.
They said, what's wrong with you? You're disrespecting our president. I mean, seriously.
Mark, it's a tough world, and where you live, especially more rural, it's got to be even tougher to deal with human beings influenced by the wrong things. And we want to be influenced by the wrong things, like the wrong kinds of music, and you've helpfully produce some of that. All right, Mark. We will talk to you soon. And this interview will be broadcast tomorrow night on our podcast. And so you guys can look for the link that's up there this Tuesday tonight. And you'll see the whole thing. We're going to be talking on the podcast with both music journalist Ira Robbins and also with Mark Bingham, and we're going to have a great night of music on the podcast, so make sure you guys tune into that, the Finns Revolution podcast. And Mark Bingham, thank you so much for joining us on Finns Revolution on WUSB Stony Brook.
Thank you, Finn. See you next time.
You will.
Yeah, so we'd like to thank Mark Bingham for joining us right there. Fantastic producer, great work with Michaud's Melody Makers, as among a gazillion other bands, and especially his work with Hal Wilner. And this podcast will be up, of course, tomorrow night. My name is Finn. I'll be back with you next week. Until then, just remember, don't do anything that I wouldn't do. I'll see you. Never.